Hi everyone, welcome back to Keep Calm and Mental Health On. I'm your host, Aditi Adiga, and today I'm really excited to welcome a guest whose work has deeply resonated with me, especially as a young South Asian youth. Our guest is a writer, speaker, and author, and spotlights mental health in the AAPI community. Before we dive in, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and share a bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Marnell Gokhale. Thank you for having me on today. I am a former journalist and I'm an author of two books on South Asian mental health. Both books are anthology that dive into topics like mental illness, disability, neurodivergence, trauma, intergenerational trauma, bicultural, living a, the bicultural life and so much more. And I'm additionally a public speaker too, in addition to being an author.
Thank you so much for that. So, to start us off, can you kind of tell listeners a bit about your experience in the AAPI community as a South Asian and how that's shaped your voice and how you advocate for mental health?
Sure. So as I mentioned, I'm an author, and although I don't have a clinical background, I am a former journalist. And as a journalist that would cover mostly community-related news back in the day, I worked for minority-owned publications, and over time I started noticing that there's mental health awareness events in the Latino and African American communities, not so much the Asian communities. And even though it was never necessarily on my bucket list to be an author, the opportunity arose in COVID when I took a free memoir writing class, and then I was like, oh, I learned about the concept of self-publishing, and I thought, I don't know a lot of South Asian people besides myself that have a journey with mental health or like therapy to share, and it would be interesting to investigate that. And I literally just put out like submission calls to nonprofit organizations, and I got lots of people interested in telling my story. And then 2 years later, I met a lot of more people throughout my networking and my public speaking that whose stories I felt needed to be told. So I published another book.
That sounds really great. That's really inspiring story. So I guess, you've shared how writing has kind of become something that you've used to tell your story. So I guess, how did that really evolve into spotlighting specifically like the AAPI community? I know that you saw that was really underrepresented.
Yeah, so it started because I didn't see any AAPI related mental health awareness related events in my city. And I live in the most, I think it's either the first or the second most segregated in the country now, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And as a result, I think that had a lot to do with it too. And basically, I felt as though even though I had South Asian and Asian American in general friends as a young adult that went off to college in the city, and I still, like I said, met none with a mental health related journey to share. And I sensed that there was a stigma because of that. And I think that, deep down inside, I could sense the stigma even as a little kid growing up who didn't always fit the confines of what a model minority myth, should look like, in the sense of like early childhood development.
Yeah, it's really powerful that you notice that and use that experience to kind of frame how you write about different things. And you've mentioned that you've published two incredible books. So I guess more than like the AAPI, was it like storytelling and getting to share the stories of the AAPI community that really brought you to want to publish a book so that it's more available and to kind of make mental health more talked about instead of silenced like it usually is in this community?
Yes, I would say South Asian specifically. I particularly did not know a lot of South Asians that talk about mental health or had a journey to share. And I thought it would be an interesting thing to investigate from a journalistic standpoint. And I wasn't necessarily planning to, I didn't, necessarily plan to become like a bestseller or something. I think I just more so wanted to be like, be, take pride in saying I published a book. And in when deciding that, I asked myself, what are some topics of interest to me? And psychology and mental health has been a big one. And I originally thought that I wouldn't get anyone interested in talking at all. But then literally I just typed in South Asian mental health into the Google search bar, an Instagram hashtag, and I found lots of public figures as well as nonprofit organizations looking to that, make it their mission to destigmatize that. And I think it's because COVID finally forced people in our community to talk. And I think that it's because of things like, as they say, things like loneliness is amplified, domestic violence and poverty, joblessness, and all these other things that affect one's mental wellness. And I think that it having been stigmatized in Eastern countries for so long, I think that was kind of like the tipping point, at least for the South Asian community. And I think that as I became published and that would network a little more and into the broader AAPI community and not just South Asian, I could find similarities, but also differences across communities in the Asian diaspora as a whole as to things like why stigma exists. Things such as like the model minority myth, academic pressure, acculturative stress in the immigrant generation, that type of thing.
So a lot of youth that I know who are South Asian do want to express themselves through different like artistic outlets, just like writing. And they're kind of scared because of the stigma and discrimination already present in the mental health area, especially for South Asians. So I guess how do you overcome some of those obstacles?
So I would say that as an author, I will admit that in terms, even though I have told my story many times, publishing a book, it is easier to tell other people's stories than my own, and it's something that I did as a journalist. However, I will say that when I published it, I did give people the option to change their name if they're not comfortable with the world knowing their story, so to speak. And I think that, and then two, when I told my story, I think that I was, before I became an author, I started slowly telling my story on things like a podcast once and a blog in another place. And I think that when I started therapy at the age of 20 and then again at 25, and I think that that's where I did seem to witness, you know, the resistance like in my family towards doing that, which eventually converted into neutrality. But I think that that is one of the, you know, one the field of fire, so to speak, that made me want to talk.
That sounds amazing. And then you also did talk about, I've heard that about your undiagnosed neurodivergence. So I guess how did discovering that like change your understanding of mental health and even your own identity being in the South Asian community?
I think that so basically I'll say that where the diagnosis came about was, you know, little bit about my story. I, as a kid growing up, so my parents will tell you that I was an advanced baby when it came to talking, and I was speaking complete sentences before the age of two. And then at some point they would start to notice like being terrified of looking at people or even saying hello to people. I think, and then even as a kid, I wouldn't say hello when people said hello to me. In school, I would get in trouble for things like missing instructions, not handing in homework on time, not doing my homework unless my parents sat in the same room as me doing it. And I struggled immensely with peer relations and reciprocal communication and friendships. And I think that due to gender bias and stuff like that, it was seen as just being a little socially anxious or a little shy or not trying hard enough. And I think racial bias probably played a role too, being that I was in a segregated city. I can count the number of South Asian kids on one hand that went to school with me all the way from 7th grade through 12th grade. And I think that things like model minority myth have that bias with when it comes to late diagnosis as well. And so basically I went to college therapy at 20 and they treated me for social anxiety and it helped me a lot. But I went back to therapy because I felt like something was still a little off in a way that I couldn't quite put my finger on. And then that's when the therapist that I worked with, within a few months, she said things to me like, you know, I try to look for patterns in my clients, and you've had some discussions about you being shy. And I think it's a little more than that. The pattern I'm picking up with you is it seems like you don't know how to read people, and people don't know how to read you. And then you say that autism runs in your family. And so I think that you should get tested for it. And so then that's when I noticed, I think that when I got into like the neurodivergent and autistic community in general, is when I started to learn a lot more about the concepts of ableism and things like just how much people seem to respect disability from an abstract perspective type thing. And I think, but still harbor a lot of internalized negative biases about it and about things like neurodiversity being a superpower and this and that, which is another cliche. And I think that these problems are amplified in the South Asian community, in the sense that you might notice in all communities that certain DSM-5 diagnoses are more looked down upon than others. Like, for example, how much does schizophrenia weigh stigma-wise in comparison to something like anxiety? So that's where I notice things like, social anxiety seems to weigh less than autism, and people seem more comfortable embracing that. ADHD seems to weigh a little less than autism, so to speak, and so on and so forth. And I think that it taught me a lot about how many myths about it need to be dispelled. And while education needs to be spread, we also can't be promoting neurodivergence as some sort of a hot trend that you can just embrace in a heartbeat without getting to the bottom of what it is clinically.
Yeah, I definitely know that whenever I open up social media, I definitely see a lot of misinformation about neurodivergence and how people kind of see it as a trend to hop on. And I know that that can be really hard for people who are actually neurodivergent. And then I also noticed that in both your writing and public speaking, you challenge stigmas in South Asian communities, and you've mentioned that there are a lot of barriers to like getting mental health treatment, as you kind of said, with your therapy journey. So I guess what are some of the other big cultural barriers that you have experienced or that you have seen in the South Asian community to having an open conversation about mental health with people around you?
So I think so in the elder generations, I think you'll see the argument of I never went to therapy, I never knew about mental health, and I turned out fine. But did you really? And I think that people measure fine. I think that things like capitalistic structures and societies measure fineness as far as things like being married, having kids, or ha and or having a job and contributing it to society in that way, which you do have to do those things, do want some of those things to an extent, in the sense that everyone must work to make a living. But at the same time, it's like, the neurodiversity paradigm, I think, was meant to challenge the notion that one brain type is superior to that of the other, and to indicate we as humans are racially diverse, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, neurologically diverse. But I think that even still, people who accept that abstractly do tend to kind of unconsciously look down upon people with quote unquote mental illness, right? Because who's to label someone ill or disordered? What if we lived in a society that made systems ex more accessible and accepting of people that deal with things like chemical imbalances or brains that fit outside of like the average norm, so to speak? And I think too that collectivism in our community too, you might see attitudes of who will marry you if they knew that you're diagnosed with X, Y, and Z, so to speak. And what's rather ironic is that even if the generations way earlier than this did not know about mental health labels, they are screening for them in a sense when it comes to things like arranged marriages. And I think too that where collectivism is a downfall in this area is when you start to think, what the collective thinks is more critical than what I feel is best for me, so to speak. And then you may fall into the ploy of, I'm not going to get help because I care what the community thinks, so to speak.
So the model minority myth is something that you've spoken about. So I guess how do you think that myth plays into the silence around mental health in the South Asian community?
So I think that first we got to know the definition of it. And my definition of it is the false ideology that certain groups of people are unequivocally and effortlessly successful, and that other marginalized folks should just suck it up and be like them. So I would say that a lot of Asian American people are kind of boxed into that by people both unconsciously and consciously. So specifically to the South Asian community, I think that a lot of people envision South Asian people as being medical doctors, engineers, programmers, gas station entrepreneurs type thing. And I think that the model minority myth is technically a colonized concept, so to speak. The pressure that Asian American people go through to fall into the model minority myth is kind of an assimilation tactic that I think that the generations prior to us kind of got hoodwinked into following into. And I think that I learned about where it originated once. I wish I remembered it better, but basically, a professor came up with the concept of, I think, Japanese people who were, doing well, saying like they're the models, so to speak. You should follow their example. In South Asian culture, I think that falling into the concept of model minority myth, which is, working in STEM, working in a STEM field, having a six-figure or higher income, being married and with kids by the time you're 30, climbing the corporate ladder is kind of, I think that, number one, it makes people feel prepared for survival. And my definition of survival is when you're constantly planning your next step and not living in the moment and you're not thriving. And then two, it looks good to other people in the community itself. So I think that while the concept of collectivism and saving face and looking good and external reputation is heavily emphasized in the AAPI community due to collectivism, I do think that, there's a reason that the phrase "lo kya kahenge" exists as a slang in our culture, and it means "what will people think" in Hindi. And I think that it does seem like South Asian cultures are much more a patriarchy driven and more obsessed with preventing family scandals and gossip, even from people that they barely know or are in touch with, in comparison to, I think, other Southeast Asian communities who I will agree, I do see the saving face concept to an extent, but I also see that, when someone in your family screws up or something happens, you take a community-oriented approach to pull each other back together again. And I think that South Asian people, from a mental health perspective, because of their obsession with external reputation, may kind of like choose to be in denial about things like what they may be, their own mental wellness not may not be the best, or that their child's may, and what and who will marry my kid if they found out that they got diagnosed with X, Y, and Z, or why can't my kid just use prayer as opposed to medication for this, or I'm okay with telling people that my so-and-so is struggling with physical illness, but psychiatric, everyone better keep their mouth shut about.
Yeah, I think there's so much pressure to kind of hide the mental health struggles that families go through to respect that image and, keep up with traditions. But thank you so much for that honesty. So I also noticed that, your journey is so like multifaceted. You're writing books about mental health and you're also speaking out about it. So, and then you were also involved in tech a little bit. And so how would you like say that you balance these identities and like how do they really intersect to tell your story along with helping other people spotlight their own?
I would say that having left the journalism world and going into corporate, I think that I feel like in our generation, in the millennial and younger generation, like the concept of having like side hustles and or a creative gig is kind of more normalized, so to speak. And that's kind of where I feel as where I came to embrace that is I feel as though it shows me that I have talents in multiple areas and being that I technically work in the tech field, not as a programmer, but as an analyst, there's things that I do genuinely like about being one and want to stay in that field for sure. But then being an author allows me to explore my creative and advocacy-based pursuits, and I think in quite frankly also prevents burnout too, because it's not my 9 to 5 that I'm hustling and scrambling to work hours and hours on end and then not get a lot in return. Now, one day it would be nice for for my corporate brand and my author brand to intersect, but I'm okay with either way.
Yeah, that sounds great. And then, so I guess what would you have, like, what kind of advice would you have for younger people who kind of feel unsure about balancing like things that are more normalized, like maybe tech jobs, science, and STEM fields, and then also like actually speaking out about their mental health through more creative fields as well?
I feel as though now there is less fear in terms of pursuing creative fields as compared to like 20 years ago or something. And I think that in general, though, when it comes to figuring out what you want, my advice is you're still young and your brain is still developing. Be passionate about as many things as possible so that you have as met have lots of options under your belt, whether it be for the full-time career that you're settling into or your side hustles or just hobbies, because you don't have to make not every venture you take on has to be a money-making thing. And I think that that'll being able to do actually being able to be passionate about things without making it a career will help you to discover who it is, who you are, and what you value and what your morals and your passions are outside of hustle life.
Yeah. And then for one of the last questions that I have, if you could kind of go back and speak to your younger self and maybe that younger version of you who was dreaming about speaking about their mental health more or something like that, what would you say to them?
I would say to my younger self that didn't receive a proper diagnosis in therapy that while you wanted to be a big city journalist, that's not going to happen, but something even bigger is going to happen to you and that you're going to take pride in, and it will all work out, and that even when we have goals, goals always change and life always changes, and that if you feel as though if something is off or wrong with you, it's not that it's not off and it's not wrong, but you are going to get your answers and you're going to live your truth within a few years.
That sounds great. And then, where can any of the listeners who would like to learn more about you and your work, including your books and the other work you do, like where can they find those, like the social media platforms and et cetera?
I'm published on Amazon, so any country that has Amazon will have it available in paperback and the Kindle. US residents can reach out to me for a signed copy for $1 less. And I'm social media wise, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and
Yeah, and I just want to say thank you so much again for joining us and sharing your voice so honestly. Your voice is not only breaking barriers in the South Asian community, but reminding young people like me that our stories also matter. So, for everyone listening, be sure to check out the links in the description to learn more about Marino's work. And don't forget to follow to stay tuned into future episodes and for conversations like this one. And until next time, this is Aditi reminding you to take care of your mind and keep calm and mental health on.